Okay, family systems. Show of hands, is there anyone here going home for the holidays? Or having home come to you for the holidays? Or maybe if you're not reuniting with a family, or is there anyone who always makes sure to incorporate cherished values and traditions and rituals from their family of origin into what they do at the holidays? Yeah. I found over the years that it's pretty predictable that it's a basic human instinct to want to connect or reconnect with the people or the rituals that are really rooted in our family of origin. And that the parents or older members of the family, if they don't have any family to go visit or to come to them, then it's very important for them to practice traditions and rituals from their family of origins, even when those traditions don't really make sense anymore. Like the story of the youngest child who, after noticing for the 20th time that his mother always cut off the end of the Christmas ham before putting it in the oven, and when he asked her why, he noticed that she became very misty-eyed and nostalgic and waxed on about family traditions and how she had learned that from her mother. And so the boy went into the other room and asked his grandmother about why they did that. And the grandmother got misty-eyed and nostalgic about everything that her mother had taught her. And so finally the boy called his great-grandmother and he heard her say, "Oh, that's just because your great-granddaddy was too cheap to buy an oven big enough to cook a decent-sized ham." How many have a similar tradition that doesn't always make sense that you make sure you repeat every year? Or worse yet, have you ever made the mistake of going against a tradition only to feel the wrath of generations racing towards you like an ogre with a salami? And how many people have scratched your head and wondered how it got this way, how so many people somewhat independently conspired to hold up a whole system of things that doesn't always make sense, and how you got so tied into it and that expected to carry it on, and there's no way to extricate yourself, even if what you're trying to look for is some sanity or some, even if you're trying to do something healthy. Well, you're in luck if that's something that you want to figure out, because what we're talking about today is family systems and family culture, which is something that I've been studying in a postgraduate course over in Bethesda at the Center for Family Process. And to begin with, I want to share with you the definition of culture that I learned recently from cultural competence consultant Beth Zemsky. She calls culture simply the way we do things around here. And I hope you get from that idea that a culture, whether it is a family culture or ethnic culture or regional or religious or political culture, is never a compilation of best practices or most healthy practices. In fact, most cultures, when you peel back the cover, are really just one dysfunction counterbalanced by an opposite and accommodating dysfunction, and stabilized by an array of accessory dysfunctions, all tied together in a collective agenda to avoid having the wheels fly off of your system and have it go careening into oblivion. And I want you to know that when I say that to describe my own family, I mean it in the nicest possible way. The truth is that we are all born into families that, in addition to offering love and nurturing, have some degree of dysfunction built into them. And if you don't like the term dysfunction, you can think of it in terms of incompleteness or limitations to the love that everyone is looking for. And encountering these limitations can lead individuals within that family or system to feel some anxiety, which inevitably get poured back into the family and cause tension or stress in relationships. And when that tension becomes too great, it leads to instability of the system. And since the stability of the system is the prime directive, you find that each person within that system is always trying in some way to increase the stability or remove some anxiety. But what happens if we're born into a family, the kind most of us have known, where a certain level of dysfunction and anxiety already exist? And in order to keep the peace between, for example, the alcoholic underfunctioning father and the critical overfunctioning mother, we suddenly get cast into the role of maybe a compliant goody-two-shoes daughter who realizes she always needs to say and do just the right things in order to keep the tension from getting too high. Or perhaps we get cast into the role of the black sheep, the youngest son, who acts out in order to get some attention and divert away the anxiety between the relationship of his parents. Or perhaps we are the mediator middle child who tries to explain everyone to everyone else so as to keep the peace, including passing on messages from one family member to another that don't talk to one another. And what happens when we realize, after doing this for years, that we're just swimming upstream and all we're trying to do is to find a way to project some semblance of being normal? Well, the truth is that when we're young, we usually don't think about it. We just find these roles, or they are given to us, and we do our best with the limited resources and perspective that we have as a young person. But as we get older and get a better sense of ourselves and a more mastering of understanding of how the world works and how we want to be in the world, then there are many that discover there may be more to this one precious life than that they've been given, and they want to step into that larger role instead of staying in that limited family dynamic situation. But what happens when we discover this and we decide that we can't do this anymore, when we come to the conclusion that we have finally sat through our last Thanksgiving dinner where insults and mashed potatoes get thrown across the table, and we decide to make it very plain and in a very dramatic farewell speech that we're going in a different direction next year? What happens when the henpecked husband suddenly signs up for assertiveness training classes, or the mediator middle child who always saved the day suddenly just rides off into the sunset instead, or the goody-two-shoes peacekeeper suddenly picks up the salami and starts beating the family matriarch? One of the likely scenarios, if you have ever been in one of these situations, is you find oftentimes an interesting uniting of the family, but for a very interesting reason, which is usually to turn against the person who is defecting and running away and convince them to come back and to continue to play the same role that they've always played so that you don't remove the stability from the family, which usually explains that leaving will make that defector a villain. And they may explain that somehow someone in the family who enjoys playing the victim role might die, and how horrible that would be to live with that on your conscience. And all of this happens because the system is so conditioned to seek and maintain stability that even when you try and move in a way that you're going to bring better health to yourself or the system, there is resistance. And it takes a tremendous amount of inertia to escape the event horizon of a dysfunctional system. Edwin Friedman, who was one of the great pioneers of family systems, wrote a book of stories called Friedman's Fables to explain some of these dynamics, and I'd like to share with you one of those stories. It's about a man who his whole life felt compelled to break free of his own limited and inhibiting patterns and routines of his life. And so one day it became clear to him how he would do this and what he had to do to go off and live the larger life that he always dreamed of. And instead of his regular routines that day, he packed his bag and he left his home, and he walked out of his neighborhood and he walked out of his village and out beyond everything that had always been his life. And at the edge of everything that he had known, he saw a bridge which extended from this place to somewhere completely different. And as soon as he saw it, he was excited. finally, he said, this is going to be his chance, his life, and he's going to live it his way. And so he walked faster. And as he approached the bridge, he looked across the bridge and saw a man walking towards him from the other direction. And he kept walking on the bridge, and soon he could make out that the man who was now about 50 yards away looked like he was carrying something. And as soon as they got about 20 yards away, he noticed that what the man was carrying was a big bundle of rope. And he noticed that an end of that rope was tied around the man's waist. And as they became almost right up against each other, he noticed that the person walking towards him said, "Pardon me, would you be so kind as to hold this end of the rope for me for a moment?" And surprised by the request and wanting to be helpful, the man on the journey instinctively reached out and took the rope. "Thank you," said the man who was carrying the rope. And then he added, "Two hands now and hold on tight," whereupon he jumped off the bridge. Startled, the man with the rope in his hand suddenly gripped it tight and prepared to be jerked with an enormous pull, which almost pulled him over the side, and he braced himself and strained to hold on, and then he looked down at the man dangling over the side in stunned disbelief. "What are you doing?" he called out to the dangling man. "I'm holding on. Hold tight." "I can't believe you just did this. This is absurd," thought the man, and he tried pulling, but he didn't have the strength to pull the man up, even as hard as he tried. "What are you doing?" he called out again. "Well, never mind that," the voice called back. "Just hold tight. If you let go, I will be lost. I'm your responsibility now." The man thought how unbelievable this was. He had finally envisioned his own calling, his own freedom. He was almost there, and now he was stuck on this stupid bridge. How long would this go on? "Who is going to come save you?" he called out. "No one is here but you. You must save me. I am your responsibility now." Becoming desperate, the man began looking for help. He searched for some place to tie the rope, but there was nothing. "What do you want from me?" he asked the hanging man. "Nothing, just your help." "Well, how can I help you? I can't pull you in, and there's no place to tie the rope." "I know that. Just hang on. That will be enough. Tie the rope around your waist. It'll be easier." "I can't keep doing this," the exasperated man said as his strength drained from him. "You must," the voice cried back. "If you let go, I will die." The man strained with the rope, but even more with his dilemma. What should he do? If he holds on, he's stuck. If he lets go, someone may die. He thought about jumping over the side himself. "That would teach this fool," he said. But then he would die. And just when he had begun to realize how much he wanted to live. So after what seemed like an eternity, an epiphany came to him. And it was such a new revelation. It seemed alien and heretical to everything in the way that he looked at it in the past. And he said very carefully, "I want you to listen. Because I mean what I'm about to say. I will no longer accept responsibility for saving your life. That responsibility I hereby give back to you." "What do you mean?" the dangling man cried, afraid. "I mean, it's up to you. You decide which way this turns out. I will become the counterweight, and you can do the pulling and bring yourself up. I will even tug a little bit from my end, but it's really all up to you what happens." And as he said this, he began unwinding the rope which he had wrapped around his waist. "What are you doing?" the dangling man protested. "You would not be so selfish. I am your responsibility. Do not do this to me." "It's clear to me that your situation is not my doing. I will stay with you while you choose whether or not to change your fate, but I haven't the power or really the interest to change it myself. What do you choose?" The man hanging protested, and again he denied responsibility. "Are you ready to save yourself?" the question came again. The hanging man said nothing and just continued to dangle. "I accept your choice then," said the man on the bridge. And he let go of the rope. So what does all this mean? What's the message? Albert Einstein once said that the great goal in life is to make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. So let me say this. What Friedman and family process theory is trying to say is not that we should take inventory of all the ropes that are handed to us and simply just let go of all of them. The goal is not to cut our ties to family and face life as a lone individual. If that were the case, we could just all leave home and never look back. We wouldn't become misty-eyed or nostalgic or have a great need for family gatherings. We could just skip the whole holiday hoopla and go out for Chinese food and a movie. This might help us to avoid unresolved problems with our family and the complexity of family systems, but it would also leave us separated from those who have the greatest understanding, the greatest wisdom and potential to help us know how to find that love that we had always been looking for and the care and the loyalty and the spiritual growth that we've always wanted. But if we always reluctantly return to these situations thinking that these are the only people who can offer us the love and the care and the loyalty that we've always wanted, we need to stop and ask ourselves, which character are we playing in that fable? Are we the one on the bridge holding on, or are we the one dangling off the side? It's true that our families of origin can often feel like the soap operas that Rick Maston described in his poem, and that some really have people who play the role of prince and princess and ogre, but we mustn't forget that just walking off the set doesn't solve the problem, because if we do, we have to realize that we just carry the same script into a sequel. And our relationships with our spouse and our children and all the people in our church and our community run from that same script that we recite over and over. Our real goal, as Friedman describes, is to become self-differentiated, which is to say, clear-minded, comfortable in our own skin, resilient and grounded. Our real goal is not to decide to love others or love ourselves. Our real goal is to figure out how to love others and still love ourselves, so that even in the midst of all the drama, we can love them without losing ourselves or losing our calling in the process. What I'm suggesting is that it might be helpful to understand going home as a spiritual practice, to ask ourselves, what needs to happen to help me differentiate so that going home doesn't feel like a suicide mission? And maybe if it does feel that way, if it is God we seek but cannot see, if we look for our soul but it eludes me, how can we seek our brothers and sisters and find all three? If we try this, we might just find the truth will come to us, writ large, on little squares of toilet paper, slipped under the door, one sheet at a time. You might find that you actually can go home every now and then, knowing that when you arrive, there will be people standing, waiting, who the first thing they will do is hand you a rope, and you will take it. That's what we do. But when you take the rope, you can do so as a spiritual practice and realize that drowning is an option. And take special note of the directions that you get from the stewardess on the flight home, and put on your own breathing device before attempting to assist others. Let me close with this poem by Mary Oliver, which I think says it all. It's called The Journey. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly began to recognize as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. May that be wisdom that guides us and stays with us and loves us and allows us to love others to the glory of life.